Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host for today, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for the great Frank Gaffney on what we think of as your intelligence briefing in the war for the free world. President Trump on a major three-nation tour of Asia this week, and of course it makes perfect sense that we would check in with our Asia duty expert, Gordon Chang, to talk about how that's going. Gordon is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Kyle.
President Trump, is in Japan right now. He's been there for some time. He had a number of things he needed to accomplish, most of them related to North Korea and the current nuclear showdown. Gordon, how did President Trump do in his time in Japan?
I think the president did very well. The thing about the Japan trip, though, is that it was baked in. This was always going to be a love fest, and it was. The important thing for President Trump was to strengthen the already strong bonds with the Japanese, and he did that perfectly. So this is a good first step to the trip. And also, we got to remember that going to Japan first is an accomplishment in and of itself. Because too often in the past, American presidents, when they started Asia trips, would either skip Japan or they would put it in the tail end, going to China first. Now China is tucked into the middle of the itinerary. It's the third nation on the five-nation tour. And we're going to our allies first, Japan and South Korea. So that by itself is an accomplishment.
And of course, President Trump, something of a showman himself, obviously understands that the significance of making someone wait in the waiting room while you have meetings with your friends first.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it, Kyle.
So the one thing that does, however, is it does mean that the trip is going to get somewhat more difficult as we go along here. Next up, he's got South Korea. Now, the South Korean Prime Minister Moon is known for being a little bit pro-appeasement when it comes to North Korea and also has a reputation as being pro-China. What does Trump need to do to get the South Koreans in line with what he needs for a tough North Korea policy?
Yeah, this is the most difficult stop on the trip, and in some ways it's the most important because the Chinese are going to take their cue from what happens in Seoul. Last Tuesday, the Chinese and the South Korean foreign ministries issued a joint statement, and in order to get the Chinese to sign on, President Moon Jae-in gave China three secret assurances, which have now become known public and are called the three no's. These are our, they did that without consulting the United States, from all that we can tell. And this certainly is an act of disloyalty. It undermines the alliance. And because of these assurances, and two of them relate to missile defense, it undercuts the ability of the United States to defend South Korea. And so, therefore, it puts our forces in the region at risk. I think President Trump needs to call this out in public, even if it means friction, because this is an important issue that just cannot left for the sake of just trying to maintain the smiling diplomacy. If President Trump can get Moon to publicly renounce the three no's, then the Chinese are going to really be put on the back foot. It makes discussions in Beijing so much easier because this is Chinese troublemaking. So President Trump has a very difficult task in South Korea. And we're not even talking about the important trade issues that are also going to be discussed. But just from this point of the three no's, President Trump has a very big item on his agenda.
Talk to us a little bit about the South Korean trade angle, though, because we know, obviously, foreign trade, very, very important to the Trump agenda. What is he going to be facing as he goes into South Korea on the trade issue?
Yeah, Our merchandise goods deficit with China has ballooned since the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement became effective in 2012. Although we're selling more services to South Korea, nonetheless, the overall trade deficit also has gotten worse. But it's not so much just the issue of the size of the deficits and the direction. The South Koreans have proven to be quite predatory traders. So, for instance, the horribly misnamed Korea Free Trade Commission just slapped a $912.3 million fine on Qualcomm. And at the same time, they have instituted a forced licensing regime. And they did all of this by denying Qualcomm its procedural guarantees that are contained in the free trade agreement. This is completely outrageous. I'm not here to argue in favor of the merits of the case because these issues are really quite complicated, but it's clear that Qualcomm got a very rough deal from the South Korean bureaucracy, and this, I believe, also needs to be reversed, and President Trump should be talking about this issue. And I know that Trump has threatened to terminate the free trade agreement. I think that's going a little bit far, especially with an ally and a crucial ally. But nonetheless, at this point, there are these issues which I believe cannot and should not be ignored at this time.
Well, when you talk about the need to raise a little friction, that certainly seems like it'll also be in President Trump's wheelhouse. So maybe he will be in a good position to do that here in South Korea.
Well, I certainly hope so, because things are not going to get too much easier in Beijing. But, you know, if President Trump is able to assert American interests effectively, the Chinese, I think, are going to sort of look up and say, my gosh, we have underestimated Trump. We got to do what he says. So this is important. So this could have good knock-on effects for the rest of the trip.
Now, talk to us about the Chinese position. They're coming off a major party Congress. How did that go, and how will it affect the future of Trump-China relations?
Well, Xi Jinping, the Chinese ruler, has consolidated his position after the 19th Communist Party Congress, which occurred in the middle of last month. In one way, that does affect the North Korea issue, because Trump can look at Xi Jinping and say, look, you know, you've now powerful as everything. You know, you almost have absolute power, it looks like. That means you no longer have any excuses to foot drag on North Korea. You can't blame anybody else. And I hope that President Trump makes that point in private, if not in public, because I think that we do have these issues, of course, with China. That, you know, the Chinese are always going to support the North Koreans unless the United States applies pressure to China. So, you know, we know the Chinese are villains. We know the North Koreans are villains. But the question is, we sometimes permit them to be villains. The Chinese will get away with as much as they can. It's up to President Trump to make sure they can't get away with anything.
Well, it sounds like then a lot hinges on the South Korea leg of this trip as we go into Beijing. Do you have any sort of predictions on where there will be friction or any traps that Trump should be careful to avoid?
In South Korea, almost everything is going to be a trap because, as you point out, Moon Jae-in is the most pro-North Korean, pro-China president of South Korea, with the possible exception of his former boss, which was President Roh Moo-hyun, who governed last decade. Moon Jae-in, if he were up to him, would do everything possible to undermine American security and his own security, I believe. So it really is up to Trump to use effective diplomacy on Moon. We got to remember that South Korea is a badly divided country. Half of it is so-called conservative. Half of it is so-called progressive. Progressive really means, you know, President Moon's way of thinking. And so Moon can't do all the things that he wants because of the other half of the electorate. And I think President Trump has to go in there, solidify America's position with the conservative portion of South Korea, and use that against President Moon. Up to now, Trump's diplomacy with Moon, which has really been quite coercive, has actually been quite effective. It's prevented Moon from doing what he wanted to do, and so the president should get credit for that. But this is not something where he can declare a final victory, because Moon will always be trying to do something to undermine the U.S., as he did last Tuesday with that joint statement with the Chinese. So it's going to be a constant struggle, and we're going to see it played out this week.
All right, Gordon, just a few seconds left. The wild card here, of course, North Korea. Are they going to stay quiet, or should we expect them to raise their voice?
I expect the North Koreans to do something provocative, like fire a missile. There are reports that the North Koreans have been moving their mobile missiles around, which is an indication that they're going to be a launch soon. So I think it could very well be during the South Korea portion of this trip, but in any event, it will occur soon.
All right, Gordon, thank you very much for joining us on Secure Freedom Radio. Coming up next, we'll be talking to Benjamin Weingarten about free speech on the Internet.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for the great Frank Gaffney. Joining me now, he's the founder and CEO of Change Up Media, LLC. His writings have appeared at The Federalist, City Journal, and Conservative Review. And he is a 2015 Publius Fellow for the Claremont Institute. My good friend, Benjamin Weingarten. Benjamin, thanks for joining us.
Kyle, thanks so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
It's always a pleasure to speak to a fellow Claremonster, so we're glad to have you. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the growing problem of free speech on the internet as it relates to jihad and jihadist terrorism. And you had a recent piece talking about a lawsuit that Prager University, PragerU, which does a number of YouTube videos related to conservative ideals, has filed against video site YouTube, which is owned by Google. Tell me a little bit about that situation and how things are coming down.
Yeah, so PragerU is engaging in what I think is perhaps the most high-profile and major attempt at lawfare when it comes to litigating with social media companies who are discriminating in some form or fashion on the basis of ideology. And you preempted this, of course, by talking about the notion of censoring counter-jihadist speech. And PragerU really represents the countering or censoring, banning, etc., flagging of any conservative content broadly. And so PragerU's suit against YouTube claims that YouTube has engaged in viewpoint discrimination, censoring and demonetizing numerous PragerU videos on a wide variety of subjects, ranging from Islamic supremacism through private property rights, free speech and the like, national security writ large, and basically says that their videos are being treated according to a double standard that discriminates against them. And what PragerU shows is that the content of their videos is substantively exactly the same as videos being put out by traditionally liberal sources. The liberal videos are not subjected to these restrictions, demonetization, etc. Their content is not disadvantaged, whereas PragerU's content is. And PragerU has tried for months in many cases to get an understanding as to why YouTube is going about censoring or demonetizing these videos, putting these restricted flags on them that stop users from seeing them when they search for content. And those efforts have been in vain, essentially. What they found is that they get different answers from YouTube every time as to what the standards are. And when they present YouTube with evidence showing that basically the same types of content are not being restricted if they're being published by liberal sources, YouTube is not giving them a satisfactory response and not removing these flags.
Now, some free speech absolutists might say, especially on the conservative side, well, YouTube is essentially a private company. Your First Amendment rights don't apply. Is that necessarily true in this case? What is it that YouTube is doing as it enters into this relationship with PragerU? You know, it's a business relationship. You can't just discriminate in a business relationship in this way. Is that right?
Yeah, so what the suit essentially argues is that YouTube represents the digital public square. And Supreme Court justices have made allusions to this concept in unrelated cases. essentially saying that the major social media companies out there, given that they provide means of communication between literally billions of people, that they constitute a digital public square. And in a digital public square, one can then make the next argument, which is First Amendment free speech rights should be protected. Now, of course, YouTube will argue, and there have been a series of other instances where this has been argued, that as a private company, when you sign up and you agree to their terms of service, you're agreeing to their terms of service. And unless YouTube is essentially putting forth terms of service and then completely rejecting them in their own actions, it's pretty tough to argue against a private enterprise saying that they should be able to do with their social media platform as they see fit. However, there are cases out there, and in particular in California, which is where this federal suit is being adjudicated, which state that essentially certain private businesses, when they do business with a certain mass of population, in effect constitute, again, a public square, and thus your basically First Amendment free speech rights must be protected in that public square. So we're basically going to see a battle between, again, this notion of you should be able to allow whoever you want or essentially turn back whoever you want as a private enterprise to do what the private enterprise wants versus the idea of free speech, and also the fact that in this case, PragerU essentially is arguing that YouTube is violating its own agreement with users, which is to treat them equally.
Well, I think that's an important point. It's also worth, I think, keeping in the back of our minds the recognition that the government is not entirely absent from this situation. We know that the U.S. government and other governments have met with the social media giants and talked about content monitoring and content restrictions, primarily as it relates to violent extremism. But there is an element of the hand of government here, isn't there?
Absolutely. And if you look at the social media companies' policies with respect to hate speech or whatever you want to call the type of content that's being classified here, but in Europe, many of these companies are being faced with authorities saying that if they host any kind of content, for example, that might be considered counter-jihadist content, they have to take it down, these social media platforms, within 24 hours or risk facing massive fines in the millions of dollars. And so in some sense, you could make the argument that these social media companies essentially preempting the U.S. government here by going after content that is conservative in nature sometimes, and specifically other times counter-jihadist in nature, basically countering in advance the heavy hand of the U.S. government, because they've seen European governments come after them for enabling oftentimes quite anodyne content from being put forth on their platforms, whether it's deemed anti-immigrant by the progressive powers that prevail in Europe, or from our perspective, if it's saying that there's a threat that's coming from foreign entities and you need to defend yourself against them.
It seems kind of curious, too, that this only ever seems to fall one way. I mean, Ben, both you and I do quite a bit of looking at jihadist social media online for analysis purposes, and there's no shortage of it. It's easy to find. ISIS, Hamas, Twitter posts, Facebook pages. How is it that the restrictions are supposed to apply to the jihadists, and they always seem to land on the counter-jihadists?
Yeah, and that's a double standard that is kind of amazing here. And in a piece for the Gatestone Institute, I go into great detail showing the counter-jihadists who are censored on social media platforms, and conversely, the jihadist groups who put out very blatant propaganda seeking to incite jihadists, in many ways coordinating their activities, and in a sense carrying out all of their operations, recruitment activities, and the like through these social media platforms. It's very blatant what their content is. You know, when there's an advertisement on Facebook from a Hamas-linked group which says you should engage in knife attacks in Israel, and here's how you should engage in those attacks, I think it would be insane to argue that that content shouldn't be taken down. But we've seen that there have been several lawsuits put out against the major social media companies arguing that, in effect, they are providing material support to the jihadist groups by not taking down content from known terrorist accounts. And the fact is that the social media companies argue they're doing everything that they can, but it's hard to understand how that can be the case when we've seen, for example, MEMRI, the Middle East Research Institute, which looks at all manner of jihadist propaganda, has shown that they have flagged numerous pieces of content linked to jihadists that have never been pulled down.
It's a major problem. We appreciate you having you on to talk about free speech. If we're going to be able to deal with this problem, it's going to have to be through free speech. So we appreciate all of your efforts, and we will be right back here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler. Joining me now is Michael Cutler. He's a retired senior special agent at the Immigration and Naturalization Services. He's also the host of the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio, and he's our expert for all things immigration. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Kyle, always a privilege to be on the program. Please tell Frank I say hi.
I will do that. He's sorry he missed you. I wanted to talk to you, Michael, a little bit about the question of immigration as it relates to this recent terror attack in New York City, the rental truck attack. Now, shortly after that attack, President Trump made a tweet commenting about the role of the diversity visa lottery, which this attacker appears to have utilized to come to the United States from Uzbekistan. Talk to us a little bit about that program, how it works, and what its role is in security threats to the U.S.
Okay. Well, supposedly, the idea was that we were not getting everybody into the United States as immigrants from every country, so they were going to develop this visa lottery so that aliens who come from countries underrepresented in the immigrant program, immigrant visa category program, could in fact come to the United States. These folks only have to pass a security background check, which is what we're supposed to do with all aliens seeking entry. They don't need a specific skill. They don't need to even have a family relationship in the United States. So this program was enacted purely to help diversify our population, I guess. I mean, how this could happen is beyond me, and both sides of the aisle supported it. By the way, my understanding was the initial impetus for it came after the Reagan amnesty of 86, because Europeans, people especially from Ireland, were underrepresented in that first amnesty, the 86 amnesty. They did not meet the requirement of having been here long enough. And what people didn't think about, and as an agent, I immediately made the connection. I said, look, when you run the border, it's easy to lie about when you came here. Most folks who come here from Ireland have passports, so we document their entry. So they can't deny what the truth is. So there's been so much fraud throughout the immigration program. And in fact, my very first hearing where I testified before Congress was back in 1997 on visa fraud and immigration benefit fraud because of the 93 terrorist attacks. Back in 93, we had two attacks, both carried out by men from the Middle East who either gamed the visa process, immigration benefits program, such as claiming political asylum, or both. Clearly, the issuance of visas and the admission of aliens into the United States subjects the United States to security threats and the potential for criminals to enter the country. You know, immigration laws have nothing to do with race, religion, or ethnicity. That's just the myth perpetrated by the open borders advocates. I call them immigration anarchists. So getting back to what happened on Tuesday, October the 31st, we have an individual from Uzbekistan, and I'm not going to say alleged because he's conceded, even boasting about the carnage that he wrecked on innocent people. 8 dead, I believe a dozen terribly injured. And his complaint was that he didn't get to kill more people. Apparently, he wanted to drive his truck on the Brooklyn Bridge. What's interesting is that within 2 days, NBC News reported that the city of New York was erecting barricade walls. They actually used the word wall. The reason I find that interesting is think of how hotly contested the notion of a wall along the Mexican border is.
That's a little bit darkly ironic, isn't it?
Isn't it? And by the way, there were also arguments being made by members of Congress about whether or not the president should be able to continue to use the authorization for use of military force to protect America against terrorists overseas. So as that debate is raging in Washington, this vicious, I don't even know what language I can use to describe him, mows down a bunch of innocent people in Manhattan. And you have delusional members of Congress. You know, really, where the starting point, and I've made this point consistently, and in fact, I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, the findings of that commission should be the starting point for any discussion about immigration. And while this guy came in under the diversity visa, think how many other terrorists on other occasions also attacked the United States by entering with different visas. Think about San Bernardino, the fiancé petition, the K-1 visa. And then the Supreme Court comes along and says, well, the president can't bar any aliens from entering the country if they have a bona fide relationship in the United States. And then they even enumerated the, you know, the K-1 petitions, people who have brothers and sisters here. And then the judge in Hawaii jumped on that and said, what about cousins and in-laws? So it's kind of like if you have any sort of relationship, we're not supposed to be able to protect ourselves from the terrorists. The Sarnaya family was here. Their two brothers carried out the deadly Boston Marathon attack.
And of course, the broader you make that exception, the easier it is to commit fraud. Am I right?
It is. But look at the fraud being perpetrated on the American people by its own politicians. We used to talk about the potential for sleeper cells, people who come here from other countries and they keep a low profile for 2, 3, 4 years, and then they carry out an attack when they're called upon. That's known as a sleeper agent. Today, when aliens are here for more than a year or so, they try to insist, they, the politicians and the media, call them homegrown. They're not homegrown. You have people who come to America with malintent, waiting for that opportunity. Do they get radicalized here? Yes, that may happen. But what I thought was really astonishing, Kyle, and this blew my mind, within an hour or two of this deadly attack on October 31st, you had the mayor of New York, the governor of New York, saying that this guy had radicalized within weeks, they thought. Then it came out that maybe he was planning this attack for a year. Then we find out that maybe he was meeting with people immediately before the attack and called somebody, again, immediately before the attack. So the question is, why in the world are politicians insisting that they use the term homegrown? Why are they insisting on denying that there may be other people involved, eager to call them lone wolves? This is about taking the immigration issue out of the equation. That's why I wrote an article for The Social Contract about how the road to tyranny is paved by censorship. When we eliminate words, we eliminate the thoughts. And that's something that George Orwell articulated.
That's a very good point, Mike. And they definitely want to keep the focus homegrown in order to avoid this larger discussion, as we know. I wanted to ask you quickly, if we could, about how the system deals with people violating our immigration laws after they've been caught. Because frequently what we're finding, I think, and you can tell us more, that they're not receiving the punishment that they ought to for violating these laws. Is that true?
Oh, that's absolutely true. And in fact, I just wrote an article for Front Page Magazine, one of several where I focused on this. I'm doing my best to try to provide the information that no one else seems to want to provide these days, because the mainstream media certainly isn't helping. I wrote an article for Front Page, A Bad Deal for the U.S., Generous Plea Bargain for Serious Human Trafficker Bodes Poorly for National Security. So we have an individual from Pakistan who is extradited back to the United States from Pakistan. He had smuggled between 80 and 100 illegal aliens into the United States that we are aware of. But this was a sophisticated scheme. He went to South America, got resident status in Brazil, and then moved these aliens, including one who had a clear nexus to the Taliban, through Latin America into the United States. What's remarkable, and most people don't know it because the media won't report on it, is that the tri-border region of Brazil, where Brazil abuts with Paraguay and Argentina, is home to terror training camps being run by Hamas, Hezbollah, probably ISIS, and Al-Qaeda. Now, I don't know with certainty that this guy was putting those people through those training camps, but the fact that he used Brazil is disconcerting. So they charge him in a plea bargain arrangement with a single count of alien smuggling. Now, think about that. We know he moved between 80 and 100. That's definite. There may have been others, and I suspect there were. But they only charge him with one, so he pleads guilty, gets 31 months in jail. Here's the problem. He's 32 years old. He gets out of jail. He will be, yes, lower. He will have less than 35 years of age, free to continue his career, if you want to call it that, of smuggling dangerous aliens into the United States from the Middle East.
Well, there you have it. Mike, I appreciate your insight on this because, you know, with immigration enforcement officers like yourself and your cohort that work so hard on this issue only to have, you know, a minimal sentencing from a judge. So that's very disconcerting. Mike, that's all the time we have, but I really appreciate you joining us here on Secure Freedom Radio, and we will be right back.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your guest host, Kyle Scheidler, filling in for the great Frank Gaffney. Joining me now is Peter Husey. He's the Director for Strategic Deterrent Studies at the Mitchell Institute for Aerospace Studies, former Senior Defense Consultant at the National Defense University Foundation, and Senior Fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
And thank you, and of course, the Center for Security Policy and all the great work you do.
Well, we appreciate it very much. Peter, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about tax reform, which is not ordinarily a national security discussion, but you raised an interesting point in a Gatestone article that you recently did about how the ongoing discussion about getting tax reform can actually be a way to help us meet the defense spending needs that we have. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, thanks. This is a very important issue. So many people seem to not understand that doing just a 2% growth rate in the economy, which is relatively poor and historically about 50% less than what has been the normal average since the end of World War II, generates about $200 billion more in revenue that the federal government takes in every year. And our bills that we need to pay that go up in price, for example, our Social Security, Medicare, interest on the debt's been relatively flat, because the Treasury just buys, the Federal Reserve just buys our bonds. But when you look at it and you say, well, what would happen if we got a 3.5% growth in the economy? Well, then instead of taking in $200 billion a year more, you take in $350 billion. And when I went back and looked at some of the history, between 2003 and 2007, when the Bush tax cuts kicked in, revenue went up $850 billion from 2003 to 2007. That was the added number. What about during the Obama administration and its recovery between 2010 and 2014, same period, revenue went up $860 billion, $10 billion more over 5 years in an economy that was 25% bigger at tax rates that were, instead of the top rate being 35%, the top rate was 40%. So obviously, the tax increase that we were all told was going to deal with the deficit did absolutely nothing in terms of revenue, and that even a smaller economy with a lower tax rate could generate as much income. Well, what about a faster growing economy, which is today is bigger than it was? You could generate $350 billion a year at 3.5% growth, which is what the tax reform is designed to do. Once you go there, you say, okay, what do we have to pay for every year that goes up in price? As I said, Medicare, Social Security, and then your poverty programs if your economy is growing, as we did in the 1990s under Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, we reduced welfare by 8 million people and put those people, those families to work. And that dramatically curtailed the price of what? Means-tested poverty programs, which you could do if you sent illegal immigrants home, and you put people in place of Americans working, they'd work on the books as well as pay taxes as well as not using poverty programs, which half of all illegal aliens, believe it or not, do. When you add that in, there's one more factor that's quite interesting is the General Accountability Office said every year in America, we lose $144 billion to Medicare and Medicaid fraud and fraud in the Earned Income Tax Credit and Child Tax Credit programs. And these are not Ma and Pa who's taken an extra deduction. These are criminal gangs that steal people's Social Security numbers. So add that into the $350 billion you would get from extra revenue, and that's $500 billion, and then add in a nominal $50, $100 billion in savings from getting rid of illegal immigration and putting Americans, more Americans to work. You can see the number easily accommodates a $70 billion increase in the defense budget, and $100 billion for Social Security and Medicare reduces the deficit a couple hundred billion dollars a year. And even if you think tax cuts don't bring any revenue, which they do, you could quote unquote pay for the $150 billion in tax cuts that is now on the table in the House and the Senate.
You know, I think that makes a really good point. And I've talked to a number of defense officials, current and former. They all say, you know, show me who has the top economy over the next decade, and I'll show you who the military power will be, right? Primarily related to discussions with China. So divorcing the idea of national security from economic health is a mistake. It makes sense what you're saying, but we obviously have a number of elements still at play there. For example, the 2011 Budget Control Act, which caps defense spending. So even if we're able to bring up the economy the way that you described, and I think that's a good step, there's going to be legislative action we're going to need in order to free defense spending in order to do the modernizations that we need. Is that right?
You're exactly right. But the key is that the Budget Act of 2010 says to do that, the rules are you have to reduce the deficit by no less than $100 billion a year, including $50 billion more in revenue and $50 billion in less in spending. So if I can save what portion of the $144 billion in fraud that I talked to you about, by the way, going up $19 billion a year, according to GAO, you can find $50 billion in the budget to cut, and I can find $50 billion in new revenue so that I can meet even that test. But you're right. You have to get rid of the stupid budget caps. And I say this to all our conservative friends out there in America that support this. You're taking one quarter of the budget, 25% of the budget, which is all conventional and military and non-military spending, and leaving aside all the entitlements and means-tested poverty programs and saying, we're going to balance the budget and tighten our belts with respect to the one part of the budget that actually protects the country and there's our national security, which in 2010, our military is being used much more than it was then. The threats we face are much greater. And in 2010, the budget that we allocated then is not realistic in terms of what we need today. You asked, you know, where should we invest? We have to recapitalize our nuclear deterrent, without which everything else goes bad. We need to do missile defense, not only just for North Korea, but Iran and Russia and China. And we need to enhance our conventional capability in cyber protection, border security, and a variety of other things critical to our national security. And that's going to take some money. It's not, however, when you think about, let's say you add all that up and you come to $80, $90 billion a year, a lot of money, but we're spending $4 trillion a year now from the federal government. In 10 years, the projection are we'll be spending $5.6 trillion. And that includes a flat defense budget. So as a percent of the federal budget, we're talking about spending a relatively small amount. When John Kennedy became president, 50% of the budget of the United States of America was defense. When Ronald Reagan became president of the United States, the defense budget was about 25%. We're talking here about, let's say, $700 billion out of $5.6 trillion. You can do the math. It's about 12%. And that's an increase of what I'm proposing. I think it should go on. $700 billion is what we need today. And in 10 years, it'll be higher than that. But just if we could get up to the $700 billion level, which the House and Senate Armed Services Committees have proposed, and we could right an enormous amount of problems and put ourselves on the right road towards recovery, because we are going to cede vast areas of the world to the Chinese and the Russians and their allies, including Islam, the wackos in Iran, plus the North Koreas and other allies of theirs. And we're not going to be able to invest. We're not going to be able to trade. We're not going to be able to travel. We're not going to be able to see freedom or liberty extended. And so you ask yourself, what the heck was the whole thing about winning the Cold War all about? Are we just going to throw away what we achieved there and in defending freedom in World War II, as well as defending freedom in places like Vietnam and Korea?
Peter, well said, and I hope all our listeners will let their legislators know exactly how important it is that we grow the economy not only for our own well-being, but also to, as you said, secure liberty and secure freedom, which is what we're all about here on Secure Freedom Radio. Peter, thank you very much. That's all the time we have for today here on Secure Freedom Radio. I've been your guest host, Kyle Scheidler. Frank Gaffney will be back tomorrow, same time, same channel.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.